Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
This is no ordinary bridge. This is one of the cathedrals of American infrastructure. It has been part of the skyline of this region for longer than many of us have been alive. So the path to normalcy will not be easy. It will not be quick. It will not be inexpensive. But we will rebuild together.
The Baltimore Harbor is the scene of towering wreckage and a major search and rescue mission after a ship slammed into a critical bridge in the middle of the night. People are missing. Dozens of questions are unanswered, and the path to normalcy for Baltimore and for the North American supply chain isn't clear yet. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Susan Bonner, and it's Tuesday, March 26th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern. Also on the podcast.
China is certainly one of the threat actors in this area, but they're not alone. There are other countries that are active in this space as well.
China is facing sanctions from the U.S. and U.K. over accusations of widespread hacking, and China could be targeting Canada too. And climate change is driving up the price of chocolate. A major container ship remains pinned under the crumpled steel of the bridge it hit and brought down overnight in Maryland. Rescuers have spent the day looking for those who were on the structure when it collapsed in mere seconds. And investigators have arrived to determine why the ship lost control and why the bridge fell like a house of cards. The CBC's Katie Simpson is at what remains of the bridge in Baltimore. She has our top story tonight.
With every minute that passes, hope slowly gives way to fear about the fate of the missing. Search and rescue helicopters look for signs of life, circling what can only be described as a remarkable sight. Huge metal girders jut out of the water where the Francis Scott Key Bridge once stood. The cargo ship at the heart of this disaster stuck, tangled in the wreckage.
Hold on, traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering.
First responders were frantically dispatched to Baltimore Harbor. A cargo ship that had left port around 1 o'clock in the morning started experiencing power problems. Maryland Governor Wes Moore says the crew on board the massive 300-meter vessel sent out a call for help with just enough time for police to halt some bridge traffic.
There was a Mayday who literally, by being able to stop cars from coming over the bridge, these people are heroes. They saved lives last night.
But it was not enough time for a construction crew doing routine maintenance. When the out-of-control ship struck a support beam on the bridge, those workers were thrown into the water, crashing alongside slabs of roadway. Two people were rescued. Six remain missing.
Everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident. At this time, we have no other indication, no other reason to believe there's any intentional act here.
U.S. President Joe Biden said the federal government will pay to rebuild the bridge as quickly as possible and provide whatever resources are needed to get the vital shipping port and state highway back up and running. Baltimore Harbor is one of the busiest ports on the U.S. East Coast, and for now, all traffic in and out is on hold.
There is no question that this will be a major and protracted impact to supply chains.
In the wake of this terrifying incident, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is trying to reassure Americans that the bridges they use every day are safe.
Well, this is a unique circumstance. I do not know of a bridge that has been constructed to withstand a direct impact from a vessel of this size.
The investigation is now just getting underway. Officials can't move quickly just yet, not until the search and rescue effort ends. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Baltimore, Maryland.
China is slamming new sanctions and charges leveled at it by the United Kingdom and the United States. The allegations center on widespread cyber espionage. Some had surfaced previously, but didn't name the country responsible until now. Canada, too, could have been a target. Chris Brown reports.
The response from Chinese officials to the hacking accusations amounted to a full-throated dressing down of both the United States and Great Britain. Stop politicizing cybersecurity and stop smearing China, said Lin Yang, the Chinese foreign ministry official in Beijing today.
It came partially in response to what British Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden told the UK House of Commons Monday.
That Chinese state-affiliated actors were responsible for two malicious cyber campaigns targeting both our democratic institutions and parliamentarians.
The campaigns allegedly involved stealing the electoral data of millions of UK voters and what Dowden called reconnaissance of the email accounts of parliamentarians critical of China.
The MPs all belong to the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. It's an international group of lawmakers that includes dozens of Canadian MPs. Luke de Pulford is the executive director.
If there were 400 email addresses targeted, then it's almost certain that that would include the Canadian members of parliament who were within the network.
While it doesn't appear the Chinese cyber attacks, which occurred in 2021 and are only being revealed now, stole any private information, de Pulford says Chinese espionage plays a very long game.
Sometimes these lower level attacks are preparatory to those more severe attacks.
Britain has sanctioned a Chinese company accused of fronting the hacking, and the United States has charged seven people. New Zealand and Australia, two other members of the so-called Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance, have issued statements condemning China's hacking, with New Zealand accusing China of being behind a 2021 hack of that country's parliament. Canada's Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc did not specifically mention any of the allegations when asked today.
We continue to work as a group of Five Eyes countries in terms of building up the resilience for critical infrastructure.
The Five Eyes have issued strongly worded joint statements in the past, but Emily Taylor, a cybersecurity expert at London's Chatham House, said the mixed response this time may hint at some disagreement over how serious the Chinese activity was.
We want to trade with China, we want their inward investment, and we don't want to upset them too much, but we are worried.
In Canada, a federal inquiry into foreign interference is set to begin tomorrow into how Canada responded to repeated efforts by foreign governments, including China, to interfere in the last two general elections. Chris Brown, CBC News, London.
And Canadian MPs have voted to open a probe into a security breach involving two former workers at a Winnipeg lab. Intelligence agencies found they shared sensitive information with China's government. Conservative Michael Chong introduced the motion today.
It's a grave and serious matter because a government scientist clandestinely collaborated with the government and the military of the People's Republic of China and was paid clandestinely by the government and the military of the People's Republic of China without the government of Canada knowing.
The scientists were fired in 2021. This is the second time conservatives have tried to trigger a probe on the matter. The first was rejected by a House Ethics Committee 3 weeks ago. Officials at the Bank of Canada are sounding the alarm. In a speech in Halifax this morning, the central bank's deputy governor said productivity in the Canadian economy is dangerously low, warning that undermines the bank's ability to bring inflation under control. Let's bring in the CBC senior business correspondent Peter Armstrong. Peter, that kind of blunt talk is rare from the bank. How concerning is this assessment?
Yeah, I think you make a really good point. You know, I often make fun of central bankers for speaking in vague, jargon-laden language. And it's that and that alone that makes the language like this from Bank of Canada Deputy Governor Carolyn Rogers just stand out so much.
That's why I want to talk about Canada's longstanding poor record on productivity and convince you just how big of a problem it is. You know those signs that say, in an emergency, break the glass? Well, it's time to break the glass.
Okay, that's the opposite of vague and understated. So before we dig into this, let's define what she's talking about when she talks about productivity.
Totally. Think of a company that shovels snow. You could buy the employees better shovels, or maybe you could buy them snow blowers, or you could buy a fleet of new trucks and hire a software engineer to figure out which streets get plowed first and in which order. So how skilled is your labor force? How can a company take advantage of economies of scale or new technology? That's what we're talking about when we talk about productivity.
This is not a new problem. Why has Canada struggled so much with this?
It's a good question, and there's no one answer, but some of its labor. Canada's population grew by 125,000 people in January, and many of those have high sought-after skills, but they're working these low-wage, low-productivity jobs as they arrive in the country. Another big issue is that Canada's got a lot of small and medium-sized businesses that are less able to take advantage of those economies of scale. But Roger says there's one more major factor.
If I had to pick the biggest concern in this area, I'd say it's competition. Simply put, businesses become more productive when they're exposed to more competition.
Okay, I hear that, and I think about the big oligopolies like our telecom sector, grocery stores. She's thinking about other things.
She's thinking about those and other things. And, you know, the question here is, how do we grow companies and thus the economy? And people like Pedro Antunes, the chief economist from the Conference Board, point to interprovincial trade and competition.
We can do that better if we had more access to markets in Canada first. And that's been an ongoing challenge. And I think there's been numbers touted that, the interprovincial trade barriers could amount to about 4% of GDP.
Okay, that's big, broad economic themes. Why should people at home care?
Well, look, the bank says it's a hedge against inflation, that as workers produce more, companies have higher margins and ability to absorb rising costs. But this is also about general prosperity, you know, funding our social programs. But either way you look at it, this matters a great deal, and that alarm bell is now firmly sounding.
Thank you, Peter.
You bet.
CBC senior business correspondent Peter Armstrong in Toronto. Coming up on the podcast, the U.S. Supreme Court considers a bid to restrict the abortion pill, the not-so-sweet story of chocolate prices, and the Toronto Raptor at the center of a gambling investigation. Access to abortion is center stage again tonight, with the U.S. Supreme Court hearing oral arguments on restricting abortion pills. The majority of abortions in the U.S. happen with a pill. It's the first time the court has heard an abortion case since it overturned Roe v. Wade. Cameron McIntosh reports.
Let their hearts beat!
Protests and counter-protests outside the U.S. Supreme Court. As pro-life groups try to get the court to uphold a lawsuit that would restrict the widely used abortion drug mifepristone. Arguing doctors prescribing it over the phone and mailing it into states with abortion bans are endangering women's lives.
Without question, the FDA's actions have made taking chemical abortion drugs less safe.
Erin Hawley is lead counsel for the Pro-Life Alliance Defending Freedom.
The FDA violated federal law and its duty to keep women safe.
Mifepristone has been approved and widely used in the U.S. for 23 years. It's also approved in 60 other countries, including Canada. During the pandemic, the FDA lifted requirements for doctors to dispense it in person. When Roe was struck down, doctors began sending pills to states with bans. Pills now account for two-thirds of U.S. abortions. Dr. Linda Prine is with the New York-based Pro-Choice Aid Access.
First month, we sent about 4,000 pills into restricted states, and now we're up to around 10,000 pills a month.
In court, the FDA argued this lawsuit threatens its authority to approve all types of drugs, saying this will open the door to courts second-guessing scientific judgments. Drug manufacturers say that could destabilize the entire industry, while both conservative and liberal justices question the role the court should play in determining how drugs should be prescribed. Some state officials are also urging the Supreme Court to stay out of it altogether. Chris Kobach is Attorney General of Kansas.
Each state, regardless of where they stand on this issue, each state has a sovereign interest in deciding that issue for itself.
In what's been a critical issue for the Biden administration, White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre says the president still wants to legislate protections lost in Roe versus Wade.
And we will continue to fight back against unprecedented attacks on women's freedom to make their own health decisions.
That the U.S. Supreme Court is being asked to rule on the safety of a drug with broad international approval is concerning to abortion advocates outside the U.S. Sabrina Baldini is vice president of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada.
That is my biggest concern about this movement in the U.S. is that it will continue to pump a lot of disinformation into the ecosystem.
A ruling is expected sometime in June or July, as the country's highest court weighs into one of the most divisive issues in U.S. politics again. Cameron McIntosh, CBC News, Winnipeg.
Two more whales have died at Ontario's Marineland Amusement Park. In a statement, Marineland cites torsion as the cause, which is abnormal twisting of the stomach. 17 whales and five other animals have died at Marineland since 2019. Ontario animal welfare officials have been investigating the Niagara Falls attraction since 2020. It's a fundamental rule of professional sports. Players can't bet on their own team. A Toronto Raptor is under investigation by the NBA over allegations of betting irregularities. Jamie Strachan reports on the basketball player at the center of a gambling plot.
Gives it to Freeman Liberty. Porter the three. Got it! A big bucket by Jonte Porter.
Even for big basketball fans, the name Jonte Porter is likely unfamiliar. Until now, the Toronto Raptors forward is a subject of an NBA investigation into gambling irregularities that could potentially have massive implications. Porter has been told to stay away from the team, says head coach Darko Rojakovic.
I cannot comment. The investigation is ongoing, and so all of those questions, they got to go straight to the league, and they will be the best equipped to answer those questions.
In sports gambling, there are wagers known as prop bets. For example, a bet on the total number of points or rebounds an individual player will get in a game, and bettors can choose whether a player will get over or under that total. Unlike betting on the overall outcome of a game, it's a bet a player could potentially directly control. The league is looking at two games where Porter barely played before pulling himself from the game with an injury.
It's definitely not good. Don't want to read too much into it and make accusations right away, but the optics are terrible.
Professional gambler and CEO of BetStamp, Rob Pozzola, points out that it ensured those betting the under on prop bets involving Porter would win.
He exits the game very early on, and what that does is it triggers essentially all the unders on all of his prop bets across the entire market, whether that's points, rebounds, assists, steals, whatever it may be, by only playing 3 or 4 minutes and getting out of the game, pretty much guarantees that all those unders are going to hit.
We don't know how much money was put down or paid out, but betting site DraftKings said prop bets involving Porter were their biggest losses of the season.
You don't tend to see betting on a player that's playing 13 minutes a game where sportsbooks build up a liability in the millions. That just doesn't happen nowadays. So it seems likely that something took place here that was a little bit fishy.
For players in all major league sports, it's been a rapid shift. Gambling once existed in the shadow. Now it's all people want to talk about, says Raptor Bruce Brown.
Nah, all my people know not to hit me up about stuff like that. Even if they do, like I won't answer. Definitely on social media. That's what everyone's DMs after games is about. But I mean, it is what it is, comes with the game.
Meaning likely more stories like this one. That much you can bet on. Jamie Strachan, CBC News, Toronto.
With the price of everything going up these days, have you noticed that chocolate has become particularly expensive? It's not your imagination. Big prices on small portions are the result of bad weather hitting cocoa crops in Africa. And as Nisha Patel reports, we may still not have seen the worst of it.
Milk chocolate is always the most popular.
The shelves at the Chocolateria in Toronto are stacked high with treats for Easter. Chocolate bunnies and lambs, eggs filled with caramel. But manager Priscilla Tallow says chocolate makers are facing a bitter reality.
There's been an obvious increase that we're feeling from our suppliers.
The price of cocoa, the key ingredient in chocolate, is soaring.
We're struggling to make ends meet without increasing prices to the point where they're no longer affordable.
Cocoa prices have nearly doubled in the past 3 months, hitting a record high of more than $10,000 a ton. Cocoa is now more expensive than copper. The majority of the world's supply comes from West Africa.
Production is down by about 30% this year.
Sophia Caradenudo is a geography professor at the University of Victoria. She says bad weather has hit harvests, which is driving prices higher.
Very unseasonal weather patterns, too much rain, not enough rain. But there's also a prevalence of disease.
So even as inflation eases around the world, extreme weather events can still damage crops, leading to huge swings in prices.
Unless we put into action very quickly our climate commitments, we're going to continue to see disruptions to our food systems.
Billy Roberts has been tracking cocoa's meteoric rise at financial firm CoBank in Chicago. He predicts the supply shortage will get worse.
The expectations are that the 24 crop is going to be even less than the 23 crop was. It's looking pretty bleak.
Hershey, a major manufacturer, hiked prices more than 7% in its latest quarter. Roberts says big chocolate makers may swap cocoa for cheaper substitutes, among other strategies for cutting costs.
Trim down the size of the candy bars a little bit so that they kind of stay at that price point that consumers want to pay for chocolate, but maybe give a little bit less of that product in the long run.
At the grocery store, the sticker shock is noticeable. Last year, a 745-gram bag of Cadbury chocolate eggs rang up at $17 a bag. This year, they can cost as much as $22.
Prices have gone way up across the board.
Shoppers like Lee Sanderson still plan to indulge this holiday weekend.
Chocolate is consumed a lot in our house, mostly by me. So we'll probably keep the tradition going. Yeah.
The chance to make memories, she says, is priceless. Nisha Patel, CBC News, Toronto.
And finally tonight,
we use a sourdough starter, which gives it some funk.
And that funk won Andy Hewin the honor of having the best slice of cheese pizza at the International Pizza Challenge last week in Las Vegas.
I like to believe that it's the dough that shines the most.
Hewin is the co-owner of Cowabunga Pizzeria in Hamilton, Ontario, a place that might conjure up images of Ninja Turtles downing their favorite pie. And that pie is made with Hewin's sourdough. It has to sit for at least 72 hours before becoming delicious. And to enter that competition in Las Vegas, Hewin had to get his sourdough there. He put a helping or two into his checked bag. And while Hewin made it to Nevada, his pizza dough did not. But he was prepared.
We typically bring a couple of doughs on the flight with us, just so that we know we can make it over.
He and his team had enough dough in their carry-ons to get him through, well, enough for the preliminary round anyway. But once he advanced to the finals, Hewin was out of dough.
We called in one of our staff members at the shop to quickly book a flight. We had the competition 7 a.m. on Thursday, and we had him fly in at midnight Wednesday night. So it was just like pretty much a buzzer beater moment.
If you're looking for tips on how to make the best dough, you'll have to convince Hewin to roll up his sleeve. He tattooed his arm with the recipe. Thanks for joining us. This has been Your World Tonight for March 26th. I'm Susan Bonner. Talk to you again.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.